and welcome to episode 11 of Bitcoin And. This morning we're just going to do some Bitcoin vital statistics, and then I've got a little bit of a morning roundup of some of the stuff that's going up on Twitter over the last couple of days. I'm going to read you Marty's Bent newsletter, the OpTech newsletter number 16, and then I'm going to try to insert a bad joke. So let's get right into this thing. Bitcoin vitals. This is from bitinfocharts.com, and it looks like right now, and it's about 10:40 central central daylight time. Price of one BTC is $6,567. There's a pretty decent spread here. Bitfinex has got it at 6,587. HitBTC 6,597. GDAX is 6,500. Bitstamp is 6,500. And Gemini has it at 6,498. So there's, I don't know, $70 spread or so. Let's see here. The number of transactions in the last 24 hours is 238,000. Average transactions per hour is about 10,000. Bitcoin sent over the last 24 hours is down. It's 881,000 BTC. Average sent per hour is 36,700. Average transaction value is down quite a bit, 3.7 BTC. And the block time holding steady at 9 minutes 57 seconds. Block size is under a meg, 744.9 kilobytes. Blocks last 24 hours, 145 blocks. And the difficulty, or the hash rate over the last 24 hours, has increased by 10.64% to 51.4 exahashes. All right. Okay. So there's the Bitcoin vital statistics for the day. Again, that comes from bitinfocharts.com. And we're going to get right into my tweet deck and look at what I've got going on for today. And I want to start out with Mr. Hodl's tweet, at Mr. Hodl, M-R-H-O-D-L, says, "Great news at Bitcoin Core _. Merchants are leaving Bcash for Bitcoin Core coin." And he has a link to the Reddit, the subreddit for BTC. And this is actually, I don't know, this is kind of wild, man. This dude just, it's like he just threw down a glove. And it's a post by NXTCHG, who is reportedly one of the big Bcash developers. And he says, public service announcement, if canonical transaction ordering is implemented in November, I will be leaving Bitcoin Cash. So CoinMix and all my other projects will be affected. So he says that CoinMix.to will be closed and moved to Bitcoin Core chain. So you need to withdraw your money from CoinMix wallets before the fork. TradeOnIC.com will be released on Bitcoin Core chain. TSBW Bitcoin Cash version will work until I sell all my remaining BCH coins and then permanently closed. You need to save your private key or move your money. Also, the GitHub repo will be deleted, so copy it if you need it. Good God. Backit.cash will be switched to Bitcoin Core with a different domain name. Steambot Key Market will be permanently closed, so you need to withdraw your balance before the fork. Tipper Stats will be permanently closed. Bitcoin Cash.vote website will be permanently closed. Donator.cash will be permanently closed. It's sad to see Bitcoin Cash fail to transition from a private to a public coin, but so be it. And as you might imagine, the comments are on fire. Like the very first one says something like, I saw one earlier. Where it was saying somebody had replied, "Is this a threat?" And it goes dismal from there. Here it is. Jonas_8 says, "Is this some kind of threat or something?" If it gets activated, it's because miners, developers, and the community wanted it to, not because it's a private coin. And yeah, it's just you, as you might imagine, this is probably just going to descend into like the ninth circle of hell, you know, flame wise. So anyway, major developer of Bcash is throwing down the glove. So there's that. Where else in? Okay, so next up is Yassine. Yassine Elman. I'm going to butcher this poor dude's last name. Sorry, Yassine, but it's at Yassine Arc, YASSINEARK, on Twitter. And he's talking about, he's got a fairly large thread about Samurai Wallet and Gotenna. And let's see if I can get through. Yeah, this isn't all that bad. Okay, so let's start at the top. I'm just going to read this to you. One, TXTenna, an application of mesh networking with Bitcoin transactions, is on the horizon thanks to Samurai Wallet and Gotenna. This is super exciting, but what does it mean exactly? An intro to mesh networks and Gotenna. I've been waiting for something like this for a while. Two, to understand mesh networks, let's first break down how they differ from typical network architectures. Your everyday devices, phones, computers, routers, etc., are commonly set up under a hub and spoke architecture. The name effectively reveals what that means. The nodes on the network, spokes, are all connected to a single center, hub. This hub serves as the access point through which all devices on the network connect to all other devices. 4. In a mesh network, the architecture is not as clearly defined. Nodes are peers, which means there is no special base station node. Data can be forwarded via a chain of peer nodes as long as each node is within range of the preceding node. These nodes can take many forms, including wireless routers, cell phones, and radios. They just need to be able to send and receive data. Gotenna Mesh's hardware is a 1-watt ultra-high frequency radio. 6. To send and receive data across the mesh network, nodes determine optimal routes through the network's routing protocol. These protocols automatically reconfigure the network based on the environment and presence of relay nodes. More nodes equals more paths equals stronger network. 7. Gotenna's mesh networking protocol, Aspen Grove, starts with initial discovery. A user sends a message out in all directions with the intent of finding the intended recipient. If the intended recipient isn't in range, a burst broadcast goes to all devices in range asking for intended recipient's whereabouts. 8. Once a relaying Gotenna mesh confirms that it can reach the, we're just going to call it IR, the intended recipient, the path to the IR will be defined and remembered. So messages between the original sender and the IR will follow the same path. 9. What about privacy? If a message is going through multiple users, what stops a relaying user from capturing that transmission? Okay, well, when a data packet is sent, it is sent to a specific destination. Only the IR holds the key to decrypting the transmission. Relayers don't. 10. So what does this mean for Bitcoin? This means that existing network infrastructure does not need to be in place for nodes to interact. TXTENA will enable off-grid broadcast of signed Bitcoin transactions from Samurai Wallet. This is huge. God knows I agree. 11. Mesh networks can host their own servers, so their users can communicate and exchange info across the mesh network itself without being connected to the larger internet. This helps with local censorship, privacy, and security. 13. How does an offline transaction work with TXTENA? When GoTENA Mesh pairs with your phone, Samurai Wallet will generate a prompt to use TXTENA. The transaction will broadcast over the network until it reaches an online TXTENA user, up to three hops away. Through the online TXTENA user, transactions are confirmed on the Bitcoin blockchain in a private confirmation message is relayed back to the original TXTENA user. 15. Long story short, you don't need the internet to use Bitcoin. And then he's got his last tweet on this tweet storm, number 16, has some links to videos and whatnot like that. But this is a really good thread. There's only one thing that I don't agree with what he says here. You don't need the internet to use Bitcoin. Somebody at one point or another is going to have their GoTENA, it's going to have to be connected to the internet to relay the Bitcoin transaction that was sent across the mesh network to mainnet. So there's going to have to be some kind of on-ramp somewhere. But still, this is a huge thing. Now, I had when this whole thing started coming out, and by the way, I agree with a lot of people that suggest that this is being criminally underreported. This is huge news. This is a big deal. I've been waiting for it for 3 years, and now that it's here, I'm super excited about it. So one of the things that I did tweet back to one of the Samurai devs a question that said, you know, basically it was like, well, you know, what about Lightning? And the answer that I got back was that it doesn't matter. In what he was trying to impart was that if you can get GoTENA to transmit anything, then anything can be transmitted. So really the only thing holding the Lightning Network back from piggybacking on mesh networks through GoTENA is, at one point or another, someone like Jack Mallers, who's too busy now anyway, and I can't do it because I'm not a developer. But if somebody can grab a hold of some GoTENA stuff, then you will be able to transmit Lightning Network on the GoTENA mesh. It's just a matter of time as to when that thing's going to be built out. But, you know, hold on to your hats, boys and girls, because this thing is starting to really, really cascade. All right, so that's it for Yassine. And then this morning, the last tweet that I've got for the morning roundup is, and I mean this sincerely, this is an oh my god triple face palm issue from yobit.net and at Yobit Exchange. So Yobit tweets this thing that it's poor little tweet is just getting savaged in the comments, just savaged and well-deserved savagery, I should say, because here's what they say. Yobit pump in 22 hours. And then they give a link to the timer. We will buy one random coin for one BTC every 1 to 2 minutes, 10 times. Parentheses, total buy amount 10 BTC, close parentheses. Now, I just can't envision a better way to beg regulators to come find me and regulate the living crap out of me. I mean, I don't even I hope that their Twitter got hacked and this is just totally bogus, because if this is real, dudes, man, no, absolutely not. This is wrong on so many levels. And it's not that I want regulators to regulate them, but regulators are going to regulate what they can regulate. And this is, I mean, everything about this is just screams, we are committing financial fraud. So pull your crap off of YoBit, go grab it, get it away from there, because God only knows what this is, other than just either a hijacked Twitter account or straight up incompetence, or they've been compromised. I don't know. But that's it for the morning roundup. Let's get on over to Marty's Bent. Okay, so our good friend Marty Bent, and if you are not following Marty Bent on Twitter, you need to, at Marty Bent, B-E-N-T, puts out a pretty much a daily newsletter of what he found, you know, interesting that day or the day before. And in this one is for today, Wednesday, October the 10th, issue number 336. Are reward halvings priced in? And first thing up is he's got a couple of tweets from Pierre Rochard. The halvings are priced in argument hinges on a very loose definition of priced in. Yes, they are, quote, priced in if we adjust for hyperbolic discounting bias, illiquidity, and bounded rationality. So Saifedean Amos replies, also not priced in because 99% of Bitcoin's addressable market, the entire world, does not even know about halvings. Knowledge is discovered gradually and not given to everyone at the same time. Why efficient market hypothesis is academic nonsense? Okay, so here's Marty's Bent on that. For some reason, there has been a lot of chatter on crypto Twitter about the effects of Bitcoin block reward halvings on price and whether or not they are priced in prior to or following the supply shock. For you freaks who do not know this, every 210,000 blocks, the amount of Bitcoin that a miner is rewarded for successfully adding a block to the chain gets cut in half. The initial reward was 50 BTC per block and has since been cut to 25 BTC per block and currently sits at 12.5 BTC per block as we sit at block 545,163. Once block 630,000 is mined, the reward will be cut again to 6.25 BTC per block. As we approach another halving, which is about a year and a half out, the great debate begins again. Are these supply shocks already priced in? Personally, I don't think so. And it's a combination of two things. What Saifedean describes in the above tweet, that it's impossible to be priced in because most of the total addressable market doesn't even understand what Bitcoin is yet, let alone the supply shocks that are halving events. And I would argue that people who are relatively new to Bitcoin and have an idea of the halving event still don't understand the abruptness of the change. Unless you've been through one before, you don't really understand the FOMO that begins to spread as soon as the halving occurs. The crunch is real, especially for miners and OTC desks that help miners liquidate the BTC they earn. I believe that these entities start demanding higher prices to cover cost, and this couples with the market narratives of, quote, the world is getting closer to a world where the 21 millionth Bitcoin has been mined, end quote, to create massive FOMO events in the 6 months to a year following the reward drop. At the end of the day, this is a silly debate in my opinion because, as Saifedean points out, information is never completely evenly distributed, so it may be impossible to have future events priced in. Nonetheless, I like to see people thinking about these things as they draw more attention to Bitcoin. But again, nothing anyone should waste too much energy on. Final thought, what do you think Bob Marley would be like if he were still alive? I think Marty that Bob Marley would be smoking a blunt and playing guitar and just basically be high as a kite and just enjoying life. That's what I think Bob Marley would be like. So, all right, that's it for Marty's Bent. Let's get to the OpTech newsletter. Bitcoin OpTech newsletter number 16, Scaling Bitcoin Special. This was from yesterday, October 9th, 2018. This week's newsletter consists entirely of summaries of several notable talks presented at the Scaling Bitcoin workshop last weekend. Since there was very little to report in our usual action items, news, and notable code changes section, we hope to return to our usual format next week. Workshop summary, Scaling Bitcoin 5, Tokyo, 2018. The fifth Scaling Bitcoin conference was held Saturday and Sunday in Tokyo, Japan. In the sections below, we provide brief overviews to some of the talks we think might be most interesting to this newsletter's readers. But we also recommend watching the complete set of videos, link provided, provided by the workshop organizers, or reading the transcripts, link provided, provided by Brian Bishop. For convenience, at the end of each summary, we directly link to its video and transcript and paper if available. Talks are listed below in the order they appeared in the workshop schedule. Warning, the following summaries may contain errors due to many of the talks describing subject well beyond the expertise of the summary author. All right, first one up, adjusting Bitcoin's block subsidy. This talk makes an intellectual inquiry into whether Bitcoin pays more for security than it needs to, and what we could do if we decided it does pay too much. The speaker makes clear that he's interested in considering the questions and providing possible answers, but that he's neither suggesting that there's a problem nor advocating for any solution. If the Bitcoin user base did think it was overpaying for security, the talk suggests options for reducing the amount of subsidy paid in the short term as the amount of security increases, but still ensuring that no more than 21 million Bitcoins are paid overall in subsidy, potentially allowing the subsidy to last much longer than currently expected. Although the talk was not about a specific proposal, an example proposal it evaluated was to reduce the subsidy by 20% every time the network's proof-of-work security doubles, measured by block creation difficulty. And then the links to the video and the transcript. Next one up, forward blocks, on-chain capacity increases without a hard fork. The research by Mark Friedenbach. One well-known method for soft forking an increase in the Bitcoin block size is extension blocks, a data structure that's invisible to nodes that haven't upgraded to the soft fork and so is not subject to their historic limits on their historic limits on block size. By itself, this is an undesirable method for increasing block size because preventing old nodes from seeing the transactions in the extension blocks also prevents them from being able to enforce any other consensus rules on those transactions, such as rules that prevent a malicious user from spreading or spending other users' bitcoins or from creating more bitcoins than allowed by the 21 million bitcoin subsidy schedule. However, one doesn't need to increase the block size to increase the amount of data that can be added to the blockchain per minute. It's also possible to increase capacity by increasing the frequency of blocks, reducing the average time between blocks. A method for gaming Bitcoin's difficulty adjustment algorithm called a time warp attack is well known among experts and has been used successfully in demonstration attacks against Bitcoin's testnet and real attacks against altcoins. Note, although Bitcoin is technically vulnerable to this attack, it'd be a slow attack that would give the user base a significant amount of time to respond. By itself, increasing block frequency is also an undesirable method for increasing capacity because shorter block intervals increase the effectiveness of miners with large amounts of hash rate and so is likely to increase mining centralization. Perhaps disproving the saying that two wrongs don't make a right, This talk describes a novel way of combining extension blocks and the time warp attack to allow both upgraded nodes and old nodes to gain the same capacity increase and see all the same transactions for validation while simultaneously slightly reducing mining centralization risk. Upgraded nodes would validate one or more extension blocks called forward blocks that provide additional block space with a centralization, reducing 15-minute average interval. But the upgraded nodes would also restrict the timestamps in legacy blocks to ensure a permanent but limited time warp attack increased the frequency of legacy blocks enough to allow them to include the same transactions that previously appeared in the forward blocks. And then there's a link, video transcript, and the paper. Next up, compact multi-signatures for smaller blockchains. Researched by Dan Bona, Manu Drivers, and Gregory Nevin. Sorry, Manu, I butchered your last name. This talk describes an alternative to the Schnorr signature scheme described in the multisig paper that makes use of pairing-based cryptography. Specifically, an adaptation of the Bone-Lin-Sockman BLS signature scheme. Although pairing-based schemes require an additional fundamental security assumption beyond those made by both Bitcoin's current ECDSA scheme and proposed Schnorr scheme, the authors present evidence that their scheme would produce smaller signatures in general, allow non-interactive signature aggregation, and make it possible to prove which members of the set of signers actually work together to create a threshold signature. Sounds interesting. Next up, accumulators, a scalable drop in replacement for Merkle trees, researched by Benedict Buns, or Bins, Benjamin Fish, and Dan Bona, or Bona. In Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies, scalable commitments to sets of information such as transactions or UTXOs are normally made using Merkle trees that allow proving an element is a member of the set by generating a proof whose size and validation cost is roughly log 2 (n) for a set of n elements. This talk described an alternative method based on RSA accumulators that provides potential benefits. The size of a proof is constant no matter how many elements are members of the set, and adding or removing elements from an accumulator can be efficiently batched, e.g. one update per block. Next up, multi-party ECDSA for scriptless Lightning Network payment channels. Research by Connor Formnecht. Routable payment channels such as those used by the Lightning Network currently use multiple opcodes from the script language that are enforced by Bitcoin's consensus rules. Previous work on scriptless scripts by Andrew Polstra has suggested that some or all of the opcodes currently used could be replaced by Schnorr public keys and signatures that would be created privately, off-chain, between the participants and the payment channel. Consensus rules would still require that a spending transaction have a valid signature that referenced a known public key, but none of the other security-related information would appear on-chain, reducing data consumption and fees, improving privacy and fungibility, and potentially improving security. Bitcoin doesn't currently support Schnorr signatures, and no complete design for it has been proposed, although such a proposal may not be far off. So this talk describes proof-of-concept results from a partial implementation of payment channel scriptless scripts that's compatible with Bitcoin's current ECDSA keys and signatures. Some impressive savings are achieved in the size of scripts and witness data, savings which increase the number of channels that can be opened or closed in a block, and which reduces the amount of transaction fee paid by users of Lightning Network payment channels. Next up, discussion. The evolution of Bitcoin script. A two-hour discussion group focused on this topic mentioned a large variety of proposed changes to Bitcoin script language. Far too many to mention here, even in summary. However, a few changes were mentioned as theoretically possible to accomplish in 2019 if the community is willing to adopt them. Bullet point: Schnorr signature scheme. An opt-in feature providing smaller signatures in all cases, faster validation, much smaller public key and signature data for cooperative multisigs, and easier compatibility with scriptless scripts. See Peter Woolley's proposed BIP, and there's a link to that. SIG#no input_unsafe. The ability to create spins without explicitly referencing which output you want to spend allows creating more efficient payment channels using the L2 protocol that also makes it easy for each channel to support up to 150 participants. See BIP 118. Next bullet point, op_checksig from stack makes it possible to create covenants that restrict what outputs a particular coin can be spent to. For example, you could put a mandatory timeout of 1 week on spins from your cold wallet. During the timeout, you could only spend the coins back into your cold wallet. But if you waited for the timeout to expire, you could spend the coins to any arbitrary address. This means that if someone stole a copy of your cold wallet's private key, you could use this mechanism to prevent them from spending your bitcoins by returning them to your cold wallet during the timeout period. Awesome. It was noted that some developers are opposed to enabling the simplest form of this opcode for fungibility reasons, although alternative approaches may be acceptable. Next bullet point, fixing the time warp bug. A set of miners controlling a majority of the hash rate can currently manipulate Bitcoin's difficulty adjustment algorithm to allow them to consistently create more than one block every 10 minutes, even without increasing overall hash rate. There's at least one simple proposal to reduce the amount of manipulation possible without breaking older software or mining equipment. See the recent email thread, and that's a link, on the Bitcoin Dev mailing list. Next up, explicit fees. Currently, fees in Bitcoin are implied by the difference between the value of the aggregated inputs and the aggregated outputs. However, the transaction could alternatively explicitly commit to the fee and allow one of the outputs to be set to the difference between the value of the aggregated inputs and the explicit fee plus all the other outputs. This could be useful for rewarding Lightning Network watchtowers that send breach remedy transactions on behalf of offline users, or it could be useful for fee bumping group transactions. Okay, that's the end of the bullet point list. He goes on, however, one member of the discussion group suggested that the only people who have comfort with soft forks are unlikely to propose a soft fork and produce software that would be adopted. People are going to fight anything that adds anything, especially considering the recent CVE. Link to that. People are going to be, for the next 6 months, significantly more conservative. It's going to be another 6 months before people are even thinking about it. I don't think we're going to get any new soft forks this year. And special thanks. We thank Andrew Polstra, Anthony Towns, Brian Bishop, and Peter Woolley for providing suggestions or answering questions related to the content of this newsletter. Any remaining errors are entirely the fault of the newsletter's authors. And then there's a couple of footnotes or one footnote. So that will do it for OpTech newsletter number 16. Now let's try something new. Let's try bad joke. What did I call it? I actually called it something. Yeah, terrible joke corner. Ta-da, terrible joke corner. Terrible joke corner. So, what did the fish say when he swam into a wall? Damn. That'll do it for episode 11 of Bitcoin And. This has been your host, David Bennett. Hope to see you on the other side real soon. You follow me at BENND77 on Twitter. And from there, you can hop on to all the rest of my miscreant dealings. Other than that, we'll see you later.